This edition of Culture with Robert Bound first aired on the 14th of January 2013. Culture is brought to you in association with the Spanish Tourist Office.
Hello and welcome to the 66th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. After our New Year look ahead last week, we're back and ready to settle into the flow of 2013 with a cultural assortment so rich and varied you'll feel like you've eaten every type of Haribo at a party and washed it down with every drink in the bar, but in a good way. Coming up today, I'll speak to James Cuno, president of the Getty Trust, about art and architecture in LA. They're calling it Pacific Standard Time.
The origin of Pacific Standard Time was our recognition that there was a series of artists who came into prominence after the Second World War and developed new ways of making art and gave a national prominence to the city of Los Angeles as a capital for the production of the visual arts.
We'll enjoy a live session right here at Midori House from Californian singer-songwriter Natalie Dawn.
If you look at any great bands, I mean, all the way back to the Beatles and before the Beatles, I mean, they had cover songs on their albums, and it was because they were a starting band and they knew that to get people to like you, you have to play things they've already heard.
And we'll meet the duo who are trying to save the songs of Papua New Guinea one scary encounter at a time.
People responded to the phrasing of the music much as you might respond to a story that you've heard for the first time. So if the music paused, people would draw their breath and wait until I put that last note on there, and then you would hear people exhale.
Plus, we'll have a quite delicious-sounding report from the Cinematique de Tangier. We'll get all horn-rimmed at Monument Books in Phnom Penh, and we'll be spellbound by a minute of sound from an Indian wedding. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. And we're all another year older now, so we know how it works. When we have a performer in session, we damn well start with that session. To kick off the new year, we hosted Natalie Dawn, a singer-songwriter, performing tracks from her debut album, How I Knew Her. From it, this is Caroline.
Ooh, Caroline, used to be clean till you met your old beau and he left you unwed. And they christened you the black sheep to keep the world from knowing what the rest of them did. Ooh, Caroline, you're not a beauty queen unlike some other siblings who shall remain unnamed. But personally, I'd say you've got them all beat, 'cause you're the only one sweet enough to live in shame. 'Cause AZ something tarnished, something borrowed, something used. Well, their imagery's outdated. Yeah, they're just a tad confused, 'cause they pushed you off a burning train and blame the fall on you. But you look just the same to me. Yeah, I don't see what they see. Ooh, 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 ooh. I just don't see what they see. Yeah, you look just the same to me. Ooh, Caroline, it brings me chagrin to see the look on your face that you believe what they say. 'Cause we all recall love at 17. If they call that obscene, they know not what they say. 'Cause they're quoting something ancient, something biased, something cruel. And I'm sure they mean to help you, but be wary of the wolves. 'Cause you're only in the pack till you start questioning the rules. And you don't look like them to me. Yeah, I don't see what they see. Ooh, 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 ooh. I just don't see what they see. So please don't change a thing, Caroline.
And And that was Natalie Dawn with Caroline, and we'll be hearing more from that session later on, as well as a brief chat with Natalie that reveals that she paid for the recording of the record with money from good souls like yourselves, dear listeners, an online community who donated cash to hear more. Anyway, that's later. And this is Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. And now to art and architecture in Los Angeles. 2011's Pacific Standard Time show across that great spread of a city celebrated the place as an inspiration for artists searching for sun, space, and maybe a little sexiness too. This year, Pacific Standard Time will switch to celebrating the architectural heritage of Los Angeles, a place where modernity kept its capital M. Jim Cuno, president and CEO of the John Paul Getty Trust, came in to talk about the wonders of Los Angeles in bricks and mortar and cantilevered roofs in steel and glass and light.
The origin of Pacific Standard Time was our recognition that there was a generation that was at risk. That is, there was a series of artists who came into prominence after the Second World War, particularly after the 1960s, and developed new ways of making art and gave a national prominence to the city of Los Angeles as a producer, as a capital for the production of the visual arts. And as they were becoming of a certain age and their dealers of a certain age and collectors of a certain age, there was a legacy, their legacy at risk. So we wanted to preserve it. So it became initially a kind of archiving of their work that led to our recognition that this was actually going to produce a series of exhibitions of some interest and publications accompanying those exhibitions. So then we went to that level. And ultimately, 10 years after beginning this project, 68 cultural institutions across Los Angeles participated in a singular event over the course of some months of last year. And it was hugely successful. I mean, I think people around the world recognized that there was a generation of artists in Los Angeles who broke the mold and who addressed the cultural consequences of the lifestyle of Los Angeles in critical and celebratory ways. And we were pleased and they were pleased.
And this year, architecture takes the spotlight in lieu of art, at least to give art a breather for a year or two, perhaps. How does that work? Is that going to be done in a similar way? There's a lot of hand-holding. You mentioned 68 institutions took part in the art edition of Pacific Standard Time. Is it one of those things when you've got everyone getting on with each other, you want to take that momentum and put it to a different use?
Yeah. I mean, after the success of this first Pacific Standard Time, we figured that we didn't want to lose the momentum that had been built and the capital that had been built around our working together and collaborating in ways that were really without precedent, I think, anywhere that we are aware. So we, by chance, were coincidentally working on similar projects, some of us, some 6, 8, now 10 institutions working on projects. So the Getty Foundation supplied some funding to jumpstart this project, looking at the building of Los Angeles really as a modern metropolis, again at the same period after the Second World War. And there are now, as I said, 10 institutions going to be presenting exhibitions over the course of some 6 months. So it's a smaller version of something that of the original Pacific Standard Time, because we're in the process of considering a second Pacific Standard Time, something that's going to repeat every, let's say, 5 or 6 years. And in the interval, there will be something called Pacific Standard Time Presents, and this is what we're talking about now, which is the architecture part of this sequence.
Right. Okay. So it's got so Pacific Standard Time is this sort of nice, sort of benevolent art and arts and sculpture umbrella, I suppose, an architecture umbrella.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So you say it's a smaller show, but it's obviously got bigger things in it. I mean, a lot of people would go to Los Angeles and say you don't need to look at any paintings and any sculptures because look at the city, for God's sake. And I guess this is something you picked up on very, very simply for this.
Yeah, well, there's a rich artistic architectural legacy in Los Angeles that people probably aren't so aware. Frank Lloyd Wright for one, but Richard Neutra for another, Schindler for another. So at the very beginning of the 20th century, in the beginnings of modernism in architecture, Los Angeles was a center of production of new architecture. Since then, it's only been more and more so. And there are a tremendous number of Pritzker Prize winners, for example, in Los Angeles, working in Los Angeles, or who have done work in Los Angeles, Frank Gehry being the most prominent, but also Renzo Piano, I.M. Pei, Tom Main. And so it's looking at the city as on the one hand, as a site of great architecture, individual buildings of distinction, and the history of such. But then it's also about the building of this megalopolis, about Los Angeles itself, which some might look at and think that it was an unplanned enterprise. But I think that we can prove that it was in fact planned. It was planned around the automobile, for example. And so you'd have nodes of centers within Los Angeles. It's not a single center like New York might be or Chicago might be or even London might be, but it is rather a series of centers, nodes, and a larger complex of interrelationships.
And you mentioned the city being sort of formed around the motor car and this sort of modernist heritage. Are there other factors come into play? Does the weather come into play? Do people want more glass? Do they want area buildings, houses, offices? Does the weather make a big difference, like it did so much for the art, like so many artists going there for the big sky?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's both about the glass, allowing the light to come in, but it's also about opening up the house so you can be outside more often than inside. So the sense of embrace of the sunlight and embrace of the cool breeze that flows off the ocean or the warm breeze that comes out of the desert. Yeah, certainly the local environment is very predictive of this, and the colors used in the buildings and the architecture, and the kind of grace of the modern lifestyle, of a kind of middle-class lifestyle on the one hand. So the domestic architecture is extremely interesting, and a distinctive regional character. And then the great buildings are indicative of a kind of confidence and optimism and rambunctious sense of humor that people in Los Angeles have.
That's the thing. I mean, why did so many of the luminary names in architecture that you mentioned come to Los Angeles to build and to practice?
Clients, on the one hand.
I guess a bit of dosh always helps, a bit of cash always helps, right?
And I guess you'd have to say open space, you know, where there's room to build. So if you're going to be building in Los Angeles or building in London, you've got to face the fact that there's less open space and there's more rigorous control over the size and shape and scale of the building in your structures. Los Angeles, that wasn't the case. They were early in the century building anew, and then in the second half of the century, building again. And so I think there's just much greater freedom of expression in Los Angeles than there is in most other built cities.
And was there a sense of sort of competition? I mean, this is always something that sort of spurs on artists occasionally, quite often, so maybe, and also architects. I mean, between some of the early the sort of founding fathers of that LA architecture, A. Quincy Jones and Frank Lloyd Wright, as you mentioned, was there a little bit of niggle and nudge between them to sort of get the best promontory on the hill in which to build their house?
Yeah, architects aren't known for their modesty or their lack of sense of competition.
This is good that you've come in and said this.
Right. So undoubtedly, the competition with each other and then with the past that preceded them and also making a claim for the future. So, yeah, I think that has to be the case. So Frank Lloyd Wright was a hugely competitive man. Frank Gehry is a competitive man. He's very, very good friends with Renzo Piano, for example, equally competitive man. And so to have the opportunity to build in sight of each other and, as it were, one-up each other is part of the motivation for producing good architecture, I think.
Yeah, and I wanted to talk about the relationship that Los Angelians have with the city and the architecture of LA itself. You know, lots of things we laud certain buildings in cities that we don't live in sometimes. Do the people of the city always love the same buildings that we all come and visit and salivate over, come Pacific Standard Time?
I think that people do in Los Angeles. I think they do like, you know, these marquee buildings and structures that are in Los Angeles defined by the architecture that we've just described. But they're equally interested in the kind of generic architecture that exists in the city. The drive-ins, for example, the car washes, the movie theaters.
And these are the most photogenic and amazing things. So many photographic monographs have been done on these subjects.
They're quite glamorous, I must say, especially as seen from the automobile. And so there will be an exhibition. Among the exhibitions is going to be looking at the city as seen from the automobile, you know, so films and photographs and so, because much of the way that we address the city in Los Angeles is from the automobile. It's not from walking along the street as it might be in London or certainly is in New York or Chicago. So that's a big part of it. It's about sweeping through the city and the low-lying structures which are geared to that sense of scale.
And this is something I think that Hockney loved about Los Angeles as well when he moved there in the 60s, is of everything seen from the motor car. I think he took a lot of pictures that turned into paintings or became the lifeblood of paintings that he did in this way. One of the Los Angeles artists that sort of plays quite big and that's part of your show for the architecture show is Ed Ruscha as well. One of my favorite works by him is the Los Angeles County Museum of Art on Fire. So he presumably had a troublesome relationship with this one building, at least. But maybe you could tell us a little about the show that he's mounting there.
Ed has produced a body of work addressing the generic architecture of Los Angeles, among them Sunset Boulevard, and documenting the structure, you know, all the structures along the Sunset Boulevard, which are mundane at the very best. But that's part of the architecture, part of the fabric of Los Angeles that he embraced. So a series of photographs and a book that resulted of just the storefronts and the facades of these structures across Sunset Boulevard. Another was a series of a kind of more humorous account of real estate opportunities, is what he called them. And they were just, you know, empty lots of one place or another, or defunct buildings and things. So it's an ironic look at the city from a very highly conceptual mind and with a good sense of humor. And so it'll be an exhibition looking at Ed's relationship to the city as a photographer and as a painter.
And just finally, I mean, how easy is it to corral a city as rambling and as wide and huge as Los Angeles into halfway between a sort of tight show and a one huge sculpture park in itself? Is it easy to sort of tie up all those strings?
Well, we were surprised, I think, at how easy it was to attract the interest of these original 68 or so cultural institutions who participated in the first Pacific Standard Time. Realizing that now we wanted to build on that, as I mentioned earlier, we couldn't do 68 within the short period of time that we had planned this, but we could do 10, as I said, and that was quite easy to get the 10 together and to corral, as you say it, the 10 to do something that was each one complementary of another. So in terms of collaboration, that was quite easy. In terms of getting people from point A to point B to see these 10 exhibitions, we think it's going to be a lot easier than getting them from point A to point B to see 68 of them, and so we were looking forward to it.
Cool. Well, for the time being, James Kuno from Pacific Standard Time. Thank you very much. And Pacific Standard Time is on around Los Angeles from April to July this year. We might well remind you that it's on nearer the time because it's a bit of a don't miss. Lots more coming up on the show, including a trip to Tangier and New Guinea. Stay tuned.
From mystical melodies at Jerez's Flamenco Festival to improvised tunes at San Sebastian's Jazz Festival, Spain's music events stretch from coast to coast. Rediscover Spain. Visit ineedspain.com.
From a breed of Italian sheep brought back from extinction to vintage recipes revitalizing the dairy business in a remote part of Norway, Monocle Films brings you inspiring tales of mountain producers on a mission.
Mikhail's restaurants depend on locally sourced produce for its recipes, which have attracted a faithful following. It's proof, if ever proof were needed, that when restaurants work in collaboration with local food producers, it's possible to make a sustainable business out of organic farming and to create a distinct regional culinary identity.
Making it work in the mountains on monocle.com.
Welcome back. And if you have just tuned in, these are the sounds of the Culture Show with me, Robert Bounds, on the mighty, mighty Monocle 24. In a moment, we're headed to Tangier, but first, Papua New Guinea. We all like an adventure, but setting out with a large musical instrument on your back, climbing jungle-covered escarpments to villages where no one speaks your language, and then proceeding to serenade them, that does seem particularly gutsy. That's just part of the story we're about to hear, about two men irresistibly drawn to the fierce and wild highlands of New Guinea and their decades-long mission to preserve the song culture of the locals for the locals. Annie Hastwell met an anthropologist and a musician who are working on a project to document the songs of Papua New Guinea, songs that have complex cultural meaning, but due to mining, missionaries and the lure of the outside world, are on the brink of extinction.
I first went to Papua New Guinea in 1962 as a school teacher. I just wanted to get to New Guinea.
50 years ago, Barry Craig found a rich culture in the remote highlands of New Guinea. The Pacific Island nation, just north of Australia, is a country of rugged mountains and jungles. It had kept communities isolated, even from each other, and virtually untouched by the outside world.
People generally looked the same as they would have for the last several hundred years, if not thousands of years there. Wore the same kinds of ornaments and clothing, if you can call it that, and behaved in a quite traditional manner.
Music was a vital part of New Guinea village life. People composed their own songs, they told stories and communicated through music. And Barry observed that much of it was inspired by the exotic birds that were a constant soundtrack to their lives.
Early one morning, I woke up, the river was high, and an elderly man was sitting there quietly, and there was loud bird calls from across the other side of the river, and then he started to sing, and so I crept the microphone up to him without saying anything and just recorded him singing with these birds in the background. And later on I discovered that he was singing about the bird that we could hear most prominently across the riverbank. quack, quack.
20 years later, in the early 1980s, Barry had moved from being a teacher to an anthropologist and was curator of PNG's National Museum. He was seeing the country change rapidly. Traditions were being lost as mining moved into remote areas. About that time, Chris Roberts, a keen young musician who also had a lifelong fascination with New Guinea, turned up on his doorstep.
When I was a child, I wanted to go to the island of New Guinea. I'd seen it on television. I was impressed. That was my fantasy, to go where people lived in mountains and the clouds were below them.
This American fellow turned up with a double bass and said that he was interested in recording traditional songs somewhere in New Guinea, and I said, well, why not go to the Oktedi area where the mine is to record the songs there before the impact of the mine might have some effect on people's traditions. It'd be good to record them now before they're lost.
Chris Roberts set off with his double bass on his back, climbing for 12 hours up a forest-covered rock escarpment through the clouds. The people of the Star Mountains were intrigued by their visitor and his instrument.
The first time people heard me play the bass, they thought it was talking. They figured that the music of the bass was actually some form of speech. And I brought the bow with me, and the first music I played was from the Baroque period. I played the music of J.S. Bach, and I also played the Mozart, and I also played them some bebop jazz. People responded to the phrasing of the music much as you might respond to a story that you've heard for the first time. So if the music paused, people would draw their breath and wait until I put that last note on there, and then, you would hear people exhale. So yes, people were listening with the kind of attention I wish I had with most audiences.
In New Guinean culture, nothing's written down, and many people were already nervous for the future of their song culture. Everything was changing. When Chris arrived and was interested in their music, they saw it as their chance to get the songs recorded and written down.
Once people saw the bass and heard concerts coming from me, people would offer me their traditional songs. What I did was write them down right away as best I could, and then I could return to the motifs in the music I had sketched and ask them more specifically what the story of the song might be. Gradually, people would teach me phrase by phrase and thought by thought what's in the songs. And I would put more detail on the transcriptions until we'd written it down right. You hear a song, you go, wow, what a wonderful song. Let's have the story of the song. And you ask what it means, and people start talking about the bird behaviors. And you go, okay. And then they show you a bird that, my goodness, what are we talking about? It takes a long time to put all this together.
Chris found, as Barry Craig had, that birds were the key to unlocking the meaning of songs. The people of Papua New Guinea felt so close to birds and knew their ways so well that they would use them as metaphors when telling stories or in ceremonies.
One kind of initiation in this area is that the young boys are taken inside a men's house, which they call Kabilam, and Kabel is the name of the hornbill. And the hornbill, the female has its eggs inside a hollow in a tree, and the male brings the food to the hole in the tree to feed the female, and then when the young chicks hatch, to also feed the young chicks. So that is what's going on in the men's cult house when the young boys are being initiated. There are men inside that are with the initiates who are called the mothers, although they're men, of course, and there are the men outside who bring the food, and they're called the fathers. So the whole idea of the hornbill's nesting habits becomes a metaphor for initiation of those young boys.
Chris Roberts and Barry Craig promised the elders in the Star Mountains that their songs would live on. Chris says it's important because they are unique.
They're personal. I think if you asked most people in other countries, have you ever kept a diary? They could say, oh, sure, I did that as a kid, or maybe I do, but I'm not going to show you. I have a lock on my diary just to make sure you can't even find it, this kind of thing. In the Star Mountains of New Guinea, everyone kept diaries of their lives through melodies, and this is a very creative melody making. If you first walk in and you hear all these tunes, you go, oh my gosh, what wonderful songs, and so many, and such variety of songs. And this is the song culture that was very much existent when I first walked into the Star Mountains. I was thrilled by it. I was inspired. And I thought, wow, everybody composes music.
The two men are just now nearing the end of the 30-year project to transcribe and translate 200 songs and return them to the people of the Star Mountains. Chris says it's lucky they started when they did.
Even before I finished the initial 12 and a half years of translating these songs, people were no longer composing like this, right? It was against the rules, and sadly, that very creative tradition I saw dissolved in front of me. But we do have the songs intact.
For Monocle on Location, I'm Annie Hastwell.
I love that. Barry Craig is head of Pacific Cultures at the South Australian Museum, and Dr. Christopher Roberts is a musician and musical anthropologist and a Fulbright scholar. The English language version of Songs of the Star Mountains has now been completed and sent to Papua New Guinea, but the lifelong project continues with the two currently working on another set of songs recorded decades ago on the Upper Sepik River. This is Culture with me, Robert Bounder. It's time for a bit of a sideways look at cinema. The Cinémathèque de Tangier is a unique space in the Moroccan city which offers cineasts a chance to enjoy movies rarely seen in Morocco, alongside promoting the cinema of the country and the wider North African and Arab world. The Cinémathèque is a place with its own colourful history, and since its opening in 2006 has become a cultural meeting point. So when the editor of that fine artistic initiative, Creative Time Reports, and our pal Marissa Matsria-Katz said she was stopping by recently for some mint tea, we couldn't resist finding out a little more.
Flanked by two soot-covered, low-rise apartment buildings sits the crisp white and red Cinema Reef. In its heyday, the 74-year-old theater screened films from Bollywood and beyond. In 1947, 50 feet from the reef's facade, was the site for King Mohammed V's speech declaring support for Moroccan independence from France. But four decades later, as televisions and DVDs became fixtures of nearly every Moroccan home, the cinema fell into a serious state of disrepair. In 1999, a group of artists led by the French-Moroccan Ito Barada decided to not only transform the reef to its former glory, but also make it a cultural hub that would serve both artists and the community alike. It reopened as the Cinémathèque de Tangier in 2006 with a robust program aimed at promoting films rarely screened in mainstream cinemas here, including a slate of Moroccan and Middle Eastern independent films. Past the cinema's library and video collection, up a narrow flight of stairs, is Moulay Ahmed Essakili, director of development for the Cinémathèque.
Cinema Reef was founded in 1938, during Tangier high times of as an international city. Over the years, essentially was abandoned. And it is in the late 1990s that a small group of artists have decided to reinvent the cinema, or the Cinema Reef. And in 2005, it reopened as the Cinémathèque de Tangier, after a major renovation work at all levels, in indoors and outdoors, and also with a new vision, because it's more than just a cinema. It used to be a classical movie theater. Nowadays it's an art and essay center for a variety of films from all over the world and all different types. Its mission is really to be a cultural center, because in addition to the screenings, which are very distinct than what you see in commercial cinemas in the country. Most of them show an average of 80% of Hollywood in movies, while here we have a large distribution from geographies and styles of movies. And in addition to the movies, it is a place where artists can gather. We have a cafe. We have youth who spend a lot of time here playing music, exchanging ideas.
The Cinematheque seems to service the community in ways that few community organizations do, particularly arts organizations in Morocco. Why did you choose to create something that would kind of fulfill this role?
Well, the founders of the Cinémathèque de Tanger believe that the cinema can be a vehicle for emancipation, for development, and for growth in a from a cultural standpoint and from a social standpoint. One of the ideas is that if it is very difficult, if not impossible, for most Moroccans to go abroad, namely in Europe and in the Western world because of visa issues, well, the Cinémathèque brings the world to them through the rich palette of movies that one can have access to here at the Cinémathèque.
A whole busload of students, yeah. Young students just arrived. What are they here for?
Well, they're here for their private screening on Friday morning. Bonjour les enfants. Bonjour.
Bonjour monsieur.
These children are coming from a couple local schools this morning to watch the movie Zarafa, an animated movie on taking place in Africa about a very special giraffe. They are a sample, if you will, of the number of kids and children from the city or from the area that come to the Cinémathèque on a regular basis to experience the magic of watching a movie in a real movie theater.
Would you say that the community of artists living in Tangier has grown as a result of the Cinémathèque?
Well, this is hard to measure how the artistic community has grown because of the Cinémathèque. But I must say that the Cinémathèque contributes in some fashion, at least, to the strengthening of this community and to the education of the artists in Tangier.
That was Moulay Ahmed Asek Ali, Director of Development for Cinématique de Tangier, speaking with Marissa Matsria-Katz for The Culture Show on Monocle 24. Still to come in part two, we get to enjoy some more of that lovely Midori House session from Natalie Dawn. We'll find out why Monument Books in Cambodia has got Guy Delaunay all excited, and we'll absorb a 60-second spectacular soundscape from an Indian wedding, courtesy of culture producer Katie Bilboa. No better place to be than here then, The Culture Show on Monocle 24. Some musical relief in the meantime. Natalie Dawn's Midori House session warmed up a cold winter's day in London. Here she is with Back to the Barracks.
I shot you in the arm, it was intentional or unintentional. My thoughts were unaware. This isn't our first wound, it'll look smaller in the morning when the light reveals the bigger wound still there. We get three good days and it's back to the barracks. Yeah, it's back to the barracks. Feeling anxious, feeling bad. We get three good days and it's back to the barracks. Wondering if there could be better days ahead. Was it long ago we walked in fields of green? There were no mines between. between the places where we roam. Now we just tiptoe as we both wait to cast the first stone. When those little goddamn minds begin to blow, we get 3 good days, then it's back to the barracks. Yeah, it's back to the barracks, feeling anxious, feeling bad. We get 3 good days, then it's back to the barracks, wondering if there could be better days ahead. You shot me in the arm, I saw your face grow pale, and we both knew so well that nothing had been won. We're trigger warning wary, and the only thing that scares me is the thought that one of us could die alone. Back to the barracks, wondering if there could be better days. I know there could be better days, so here's to all those better days ahead.
That was Natalie Dawn performing Back to the Barracks at our Midori House session last week. Then we had a chat. Natalie's interesting approach to funding the recording of her album aside, how on earth did she get almost 10 million YouTube hits for covering a Beyoncé song? Here we find out.
Before I signed, I did a crowdsourcing thing where I asked people to give me money to make music, and it worked.
That's kind of becoming, it's kind of becoming more common, that sort of thing. But how does it start? It's quite a daunting prospect, starting off with putting, I don't know, dimes in a jar, right?
Yeah, no, it certainly is. I'd seen a couple other people do it, so I, you know, the basic idea is that you offer people things in exchange for funding your project. Uh-huh. And so I was offering people things like paintings, items of clothing that I'd worn in Pamplemousse videos, things like that. And I set the goal at 20K. And then by the end of my 50-day project, I'd managed to raise over $100,000, which is crazy.
And how's that work? Do you put progress reports up on YouTube and stuff and go, this is what where we are now. And if you want to hear the rest of this song, if you want to hear the chorus.
yeah, basically, I just give everyone an ultimatum every time. Within the first week, my 20,000 goal had been reached already, but I wanted to keep it going because the project was still open, and I knew I had this inkling that I would maybe need more money to record an album, and I was right. So I kept on putting up videos, and usually cover songs because those get the most hits. And so I would put up videos, and at the end I would say, hey, if you like this, you should go check out my Kickstarter.
And the cover versions you did, Single Ladies, Beyoncé, which is great. Very nice kind of deconstructed version of that very bombastic kind of song. And that's recorded under the name Pamplemousse, is with your mate Joe.
Jack Conti. Yeah.
I call him Joe.
Yeah. Well, most of his friends do.
Whatever. I know. If only you knew him that well, Natalie. and that's an interesting tag. That has. And I can't, before we started the interview, I went and watched it again on YouTube. 9,784,156 views.
Yeah, that's correct. I don't have that number memorized, but I'm going to go with it.
There's probably maybe another 1,000 now by the time people are listening to this.
Yeah.
And that's a cool thing. So was that kind of a, you maybe like the song, although there's obviously a little bit in it that you don't like, which is quite amusing, but is that a good way of kind of crowd sourcing to kind of do an amusing cover version of something?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, a lot of people don't want to make covers. They think it's cheap, or, you know, it's just, I don't know.
It's not cheap. The
thing is, you know, if you look at any great bands, I mean, all the way back to the Beatles and before the Beatles, I mean, they had cover songs on their albums, and it was because they were a starting band and they knew that to get people to like you, you have to play things they've already heard. And people don't know to search for Pamplemousse if they've never heard of us and don't even know that it's a thing. So if you want people to discover you, you're better off covering a song, and you're better off covering a very popular song that's already getting lots of views on YouTube.
Very wise.
Yeah.
Now, our listeners will know from hearing your Midori House session just now that the lyrical concerns of the record, How I Knew Her, are possibly different to those of Single Ladies Put a Ring on It by Beyoncé.
Yeah.
Am
well,
I right?
You know, Beyoncé was my main inspiration for the album. But aside from that, you're right. The solo material that I've done is quite different from the band.
Yeah.
And it's not quite as pop. It's far more folk, singer-songwriter, quite a bit more introspective and focused on lyrics.
And it seems like, It seems to me, it does seem like a rootsy American folky sound that you have.
Oh, yeah.
Because I wonder where you got that sound from. Is that from your parents' records or whatever? I mean, I wonder where that rootsy folksy sound kind of came from.
You know, it came later in life, to be honest.
Yeah.
When it wasn't until I went to college that I started listening to people like Conor Oberst and Elliot Smith and really started exploring the great, you know, singer,
the mother load of singer songwriters.
Yeah. And same thing for, you know, Jenny Lewis and Rilo Kiley.
Yeah.
You know, people like that, and just sort of fell in love with that.
And how lyrically do you think that growing up with parents as missionaries is? Some of your tracks kind of like reference kind of Greek myth and things like that, is healthy, some healthy
no.
book learning there,
having,
right?
having a very strong religious background hasn't affected me in the slightest lyrically. It absolutely has. It comes out. I'm definitely processing a lot of what I was taught when I was younger and have sort of strayed from in my adulthood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And playing with band, you played for us, it sounded lovely, on your acoustic guitar, which you said dates back from when? It's an
from
old
1910.
And handsome instrument.
Yeah, it is. It's this tiny little parlor guitar. It's a parlor guitar made by Sears and Roebuck back before they were making dishwashers.
I don't see much. I don't see much kind of design DNA between the two. Thank God.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you though, what it's like. You're touring the record around Europe, I guess, as well as the US when it drops. Does that work when you write your songs on your own? It seems kind of like easy to write the lyrics first and pluck away. But how does it work when you've got a full band? You like being on stage with some kind of people to make eye contact with and kind of time with.
It's way more fun to be playing with a band, absolutely. And that's how I wanted to make the record in the first place. I mean, the way we recorded it was live tracking with a band, people in a room that were really playing together. And that's why I picked really great musicians to be on the record, and I'll be touring with great musicians as well. And it is quite a bit more fun, you know, even though I wrote the songs on guitar and they work just with voice and guitar, having it filled out with upright bass and electric guitar and mandolin and drums, it really beefs it up.
And if they're not present and correct at live performances and on the record, you've only got us to blame because we haven't put enough money into your savings jar,
yeah,
your Kickstarter
absolutely.
Account, right?
Absolutely.
One day it'll be like the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra.
Yeah.
If people just put enough money in.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the dream.
I'll just keep adding more people to
be
the
like Band-Aid.
It'll be like Hooray. Beirut by the end of it.
That was Natalie Dawn chatting to me a little earlier on. And Natalie's debut album, How I Knew Her, is out on Nonesuch Records next month. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. After this interlude, we'll be hearing about what might be Cambodia's bestest bookshop. Stay tuned.
Whether you're sampling gourmet treats at Madrid's Gastro Festival or visiting the Rioja region during the wine harvest, Spain serves up the very best in cuisine and wines. Discover a taste for Spain. Visit ineedspain.com.
This is Culture on Monocle 24. Welcome back. Now to the business of books. And if bookshops are to survive the challenging times they're facing, it may help if they're tightly connected to their community. That's certainly the case for Monument Books. It's been serving the people of Cambodia's capital, Phnom Penh, for almost 20 years, even expanding in recent years. And as our correspondent Guy Zeloni reports, it's loved by locals and expats alike.
At first glance, Monument Books seems about as old school as you could possibly get. Inside this French colonial building, there's a subdued atmosphere and rows of dark-stained shelves. They're packed with everything from the colourful jackets of international bestsellers to the rather more subdued tomes on the region's history and religions. And this is a vibe which has been very carefully curated by the people who run the place.
My name is William Bagley. I've been in Cambodia now for 4 years, and I'm the group purchasing manager for Monument Books. Monument Books is the only international bookshop in Cambodia. We try to make this as world class as possible. We thought that it should look a bit more like a library, so we have got wooden shelves displays. We don't have MDF units. We have built specially designed shelves to make this look a high quality area to walk into.
The sweltering heat might scream Southeast Asia, but William Bagley says that for a bookseller, Phnom Penh is more like an English university town. There's a mix of local and international customers, most of them well-educated. There's also a small community of local authors, writing everything from travel guides to thrillers set in the region. For them, Monument Books is a vital hub, a place where they can launch new titles and connect directly with their readers.
I've been really happy to have my book in English available in Monument Books, and then more recently they helped promote the Khmer edition. This was something pretty exciting.
Helen Jarvis is one of the more notable writers based in Phnom Penh. She spent years working to set up the Khmer Rouge Tribunal and launched her book, Getting Away with Genocide, at Monument.
For writers to have their works readily accessible and not just in a market stall where you had to know, go to such and such a market and stall number 327 on the south side, but if you can direct them to Monument Books, which is on a fairly prominent building, I think it's easier for the writers as well.
In other cities in the region, you've got big chain bookstores like Kinokuniya or Asia Books, and before its demise there was Borders as well. In Cambodia, the only bookshop of any size really is Monument, which is independent. What's the importance of that, do you think?
One thing that is quite nice as an author, but also as a reader, that Monument is quite open to suggestions and encouragement to acquire certain titles.
But the old cliche about time moving more slowly in Southeast Asia is no longer true. People in Cambodia are embracing new technology at a rapid rate and can easily choose to read books on their phones, computers, or tablets. So Monument has had to adapt to keep the customers coming. A smoothie from the in-store branch of the Blue Pumpkin Cafe is one method of dealing with Phnom Penh's tropical heat. It's also a way of making Monument a destination for meetings and meals, and the founder of the company, Meng Hiang, says that's been a big factor in keeping the shop profitable.
You are absolutely right. It's a destination. So we created this place to be a destination, to be a place for family to come.
Monument's toy section has also been a screaming success. Cunningly sited upstairs, it means parents have time to browse for books while their offspring peruse the playthings.
We turn our warehouse into a toy store, and we launch Mattel for the very first time in Cambodia, and we had that crowd. And from there, I see any kind of people, Cambodian foreigners, people I've never seen before, and they just flooded this place. I feel a little awkward because people say that they spend too much money, the kids always remind them about this place. And I said, don't worry, I'll do something and give it back to your children. So we regularly organized activities like origami, like storytelling, magic show, face paint, balloon twist thing.
But hanging over all this optimism is the big question that vexes booksellers the world over. How can they plan for a future that's full of e-readers?
I think Cambodia is less affected. Here is quite costly if you want to have an internet set at your home. English language is also a barrier. So it might take a bit more time. And as I said, I'm also prepared myself. whenever the tough time is there, I'll have to take a quick decision. So
perhaps Monument Books will continue to buck the trend. It started when international retailers didn't have any interest in Cambodia and thrived while the big-name bookshops were going backwards. Now, it's unlikely to face too much competition, and with its roots deep in the local community, it feels more and more like a fixture of Phnom Penh life. For Monocle, in Phnom Penh, this is Guy Delaunay.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Can you believe it? We're nearly out of time, but fear not. We still have one more song from Natalie Dawn to come. And first, it's time to sit back, relax, close your eyes and enjoy a 60-second immersion in a slightly inexplicable oral experiment. Yes, that's right, the Minute of Sound is back for 2013. And when culture producer Katie Bulbeau went off to India for a wedding this Christmas, she couldn't help taking along her microphone and capturing some of it for your enjoyment. And those were the sounds of an Indian wedding, courtesy of our culture producer, Katie Bulbeau there. That's what she got up to over Christmas. Some of the sounds distinctly pucker, some of them sounding like they might have been nicked from Simon and Garfunkel. And that's just about all we have time for this week. Next week, we'll be asking, what's in store at ArtStage Singapore, etc. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilburn. And the show was mixed by Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from our Midori House session from Natalie Dawn. This is I Just Wanted You to Get Old. Thanks for tuning in.
I just wanted you to get old, like the army green Volvo and the toys we sold, like the books that you read me and the jokes you told. I just wanted you to get old. I just wanted you to get old, like vacations in Tahoe and your skiing poles, the ones I held on too tightly till you said let go. Oh, I just wanted you to get old. And I'm sorry that I never get around to picking up the phone or staying home. I swear to God that I must be the worst person I've found. Tell me, would it be too late to appreciate you? I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, 'cause I still want you to get old. Please forgive me, I know it doesn't always show, but I'll try.